So I'd like to continue to read a little bit from Krupa Ajahn, and wanted to read just a series of questions and answers with Ajahn Wanchai. And the questions are being asked from monks from Wat Pa Nanachat. So the first question: how deep does the chitta have to be in samadhi in order that investigation goes beyond the superficial? Answer: people are different. For some people, as they investigate, their minds become peaceful. If investigation is properly done, it leads to peace of mind. Both aspects will develop and gain strength side by side. In the time of the Buddha, some of the monks realized enlightenment very quickly due to samadhi and punya advancing together. On the other hand, some people have to develop tranquility first because they think too much. If there's no samadhi, if the mind isn't firmly established, it's imperative to develop tranquility first. Whatever level of tranquility has been reached, wisdom develops accordingly. This is definitely the case. However peaceful you are, however deep the peace of mind, even if it's just a little, this opens the door to wisdom. It's like someone with bad eyesight. Whether short or long-sighted, they can see well enough to get by. Even though they don't see things clearly, they can still contemplate, but only with limited clarity. However, once they've put on a pair of glasses with the right prescription, they see more clearly. Investigation becomes more refined. You don't have to wait to get your pair of glasses before you can see. Most people in this day and age are highly educated, replete with knowledge and information, and well-trained in thinking. These people need to develop peace and tranquility. It fits them. It's the middle way. Krupa Ajahns teach us to develop meditation using a mantra to train in bhavana in order that there will first be a foundation of tranquility. Like someone who's very short or long-sighted, everything seen is blurry. There's only one thing to do: get a pair of glasses. Even if the glasses aren't good, it's still better than nothing. They're not perfect, but they're good enough. You see better than before, contemplate better than before. If the prescription's excellent, however, our vision will be very sharp and contemplation will quickly be crystal clear. Any level of tranquility is good, but you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait for tranquility to arise first. Really look at your own personal tendencies. If you're an obsessive thinker, you should seek to calm the mind. If we're naturally peaceful and don't like engaging the mind, we have to work on developing wisdom. That's the way practice is. If I were to tell you to attain such and such a level of tranquility first, I wouldn't be right, because it might not suit some of your temperaments. For those who don't naturally incline to using the intellect, they should exercise their brains a bit. For those whose thinking is out of control, they have to really clamp down on it. Get to know yourselves, work on your tendencies, replace them with new ones, bring them in line with the Buddha's Dhamma. Do you understand? And yesterday's questions, did you get it all? Response: yes, sir. Ajahn Wanchai says, I'm just giving brief answers for now, because these are very wide subjects. I can set you going in the right direction, but you'll have to learn and see for yourselves. Anything else? Question: is the still, bright, and peaceful chitta of samadhi within the five khandhas or independent of them? Answer: whether the chitta is still or whether it's moving, it's never one and the same as the five khandhas. At all times, for all beings, they're completely different things. A sotapanna, one who has penetrated the Dhamma, knows this unquestionably, knows this to be 100% true, and understands that they're separate. Whatever the case, they're always different things. The chitta and five khandhas of an ordinary person are separate, of the Buddha are separate, of hell beings are separate, but because of defilements there's grasping. This right here, this is the truth of Dhamma. For all beings, the chitta and the five khandhas are not one and the same. But we don't see. We have to train so we can see. Once seeing, there's no fear of death. The five khandhas die, but the citta does not die. This is the answer to yesterday's question about how to overcome the fear of death. Because of kilesas, the citta and the five khandhas appear to be mixed together. This is the point in question. Are the citta and the five khandhas one and the same? Whenever the citta and the five khandhas are the same, then when the five khandhas die, we must die too, and so we're afraid. The Sotapanna sees the truth, contemplates the truth. He knows that none of the five khandhas are the same as the citta. No matter whether the mind is unified in samadhi or not, they're not one and the same. It's just like water. Normally it's clear, but when dye is added, black dye, say, then it's as if the water itself is black. If we add red, it looks red. But actually, the true nature of water is that it remains clear. The blackness is something else which masks the clarity. They aren't one and the same. Red, green, or whatever, the color is simply an added quality that can be separated out. Once able to separate it, we fully realize that the water was clear the entire time. When they're mixed together again, there will be no doubt whatsoever. When the black dye is introduced, there will be no doubt. The blackness is a separate thing. It's the same for all beings. Even when the mind isn't unified, it's still clearly known that the citta is one thing and the five khandhas are another. There's no problem at all for one who has already seen this. You see, for all beings without exception, they're never one and the same. It's this that the Buddha knew. This is where he knew the truth. This isn't something we try to create. It's for us to penetrate with wisdom. If one is always constructing a citta and five khandhas, which are one and the same, no one will be getting enlightened because one will always think they're the same. They're not the same, so it's impossible that anyone could make them such. The Buddha simply penetrated this with his wisdom. Having known this, he found the path leading to the vision of Dhamma, the path to realize Dhamma. The citta and the five khandhas never combine, so that there is no need to separate them. The only thing that we have to do is to fully comprehend the truth of the way they already are. Trying to separate the citta and the five khandhas will die empty-handed. There's absolutely no way we'll ever see the truth. There's only misguided wisdom. What's necessary is simply to take wisdom and look to observe things as they already are. The truth that the Buddha discovered was already there. He didn't invent it. The already existing truth has continually been there. Having uncovered the truth, fear evaporated, and so did greed. What would be the point of being greedy or afraid? Because however you look at it, the citta and the five khandhas are never one and the same. This is supreme peace. Any doubts about that? And the response, the citta that is not born does not die? Answer, the citta is already not born. It's not something that arises. It simply is. The citta is never born. The citta has nothing to do with birth and death. It's only the elements and khandhas that are bound up with birth and death. When the citta arises with a living being, we call that birth. When that body breaks up, we call that death. But the citta doesn't die along with it. Before coming to a new existence, before taking on a new set of khandhas, this is what we're referring to when we say one is not reborn. But rebirth doesn't refer to the citta, which does not arise as khandhas in any realm or in any being. It's not the citta that arises. It was never born, has never died. You can't say at this point that it's not born. You can't say it's not born and therefore doesn't die. The cittas of all beings have never been born, have never died. Arising in a new existence, a new life, this is what we mean by birth and death. This is how truth is seen, so there's no greed, no fear. Question. Why do the Kruba Ajahns emphasize frequent investigation of the body? Answer. Because it's what we can see most clearly. When we love the body. When we're afraid due to the body. Afraid the body will die. Because we are under the impression it's ours. It's the thing that is most easily seen. We don't have to go shopping for one. We've got one right here. From the day we're born, carrying right on through to the present, whatever we've been through, whatever our body has been through, that's the easiest thing to look back on and contemplate. So, for example, we can see what things led to our dukkha, how and when we've been sick and in pain, when we have suffered from heat, experienced pangs of hunger, been parched with thirst, or when we have struggled with being too cold. These things are already available for our contemplation, so we can see them easiest. There's no need to go and find anything else. When contemplating, first take up the things which are most easily seen, these bodies. Once we have clearly investigated this body, our contemplation will continue on by itself to investigate the citta and the namakandas, vedana, sanya, sankara, and vijnana. We don't have to borrow a body from anyone, because we've all got one already. We've all experienced it. From the day we're born until now, we've experienced the world with these bodies. It's a source of much information. We're full of memories bound up with this body, and all these memories and perceptions can be used to our benefit, those which are pleasant, those which are painful. It's the same for others. We can look at other people as well. Other people are born and they die. They experience pain and suffering. This is why the Krupa Ajahns have us investigate the body. It's the clearest and most available thing for contemplation. Furthermore, if the citta unifies in samadhi as a result of investigating the body, such unification is exceptionally good. United due to both samadhi and punya, the samadhi that is born of body investigation is particularly firm and unwavering, and is a base from which wisdom can easily arise. Because we are already thoroughly familiar with investigating the body, wisdom arises easily. Question: can an enlightened person express defiled emotions? Answer: although what is expressed may look to others like defiled emotions, for the enlightened person there is no sense of having any. What appear to be defiled emotions are simply other people's interpretations, perceiving him to be like this or like that. In reality, there's no longer movement in the heart of one who is enlightened. It's other people who project meaning, and they're the ones who have to experience the repercussions. It can create obstacles in bhavana. Whatever we observe, we give a particular meaning, and if we misinterpret it, it can lead to much misunderstanding. It's actually kilesas which add meaning, so it looks to others like an Arya Pugala is angry, greedy, that he's like this or like that, while in actual fact he's not. There's no way we'll ever understand this until we ourselves reach that level. Having done it ourselves, we'll understand him and understand Dhamma as well. One who sees the Dhamma sees the Tathagata. Those who've penetrated the Dhamma for themselves have no doubts about the Buddha, no doubts regarding the Sangha. It's inevitable that anyone who hasn't seen the Dhamma will have periodic doubts. Vicikicca, doubt. It only ceases when one has developed bhavana sufficiently to know for oneself. Ordinarily, there will have to be uncertainty, because one can rely on what one sees, observing the behavior of someone else's body. That body has a history of habitual behavior patterns that used to arise from kilesa, behavior that can look just like anger or greed. But the Arya Pugala's heart is different from ours. Question: is this the case even for a Sotapanna, Tanajan? Answer: Sotapannas still express defiled emotions. It's only the Arahant who has no such moods. The Sotapanna still has some sensual desire, but he has the means to quickly still it. There's some anger, but that can be quickly stilled. The Arahant doesn't have anything, so there's no dukkha. The Sotapanna still suffers. There's sukha remaining, dukkha remaining. However, the Sotapanna no longer has any fear of death. There's no longer any unreasonable sensual desire or anger. Look here. The Buddha taught us to look at our own heart more than anything else. By looking at others, we'll never understand. It's just like what we've read and studied in the life story of the Buddha. After he was newly enlightened and was on his way to teach his first 5 disciples, he met a Brahmin on the path who was impressed by the Buddha's beauty. Remember? The Brahmin asked him, "Why, friend, is your complexion so radiant? Who is your teacher?" "I have no teacher," he replied. "I am the Buddha." That Brahmin saw him, but he still didn't believe him. You see, there's no way to ever know him by simply looking at his body. It takes someone who has seen the Dhamma. That person will see the Tathagata. By looking at the bodies of others, one can't know who's got what. But for someone who's seen the Dhamma, even if they have never met the Buddha, they know him. People these days, that is, our Krupa Ajahns, have never laid eyes on the Buddha, yet they know the Buddha, because they've laid eyes on the Dhamma. Your average person, however, even if he's looking right at the Buddha, will never know him, and won't believe he's seen the Buddha. Only the external form is seen, only the body. One who sees the Dhamma sees me. It takes seeing the Dhamma for someone to be finished with such doubt. Otherwise, there will always be a certain amount of uncertainty. You've never seen Lung Pu Bantat, Venerable Ajahn Mahabua, tell someone off. He was fierce. He was very, very tough and could appear enraged. At times he'd hit a dog with a stick as well. I was there and it made me wonder. I had some doubts, but they weren't as strong as my faith in him. It was impossible to refrain from having any doubts, because I didn't yet know for myself. I had to wonder sometimes. It's necessary to realize that doubt arises from kilesas. It doesn't arise from Dhamma. So we've got to try and remedy it, try to overcome it. Pachatang, all those who know for themselves, each knowing their own citta. Whatever other people's cittas may be like, just be aware of your own. This is the most difficult one. It's only when one has realized enlightenment that doubt will truly be finished with. Until we've penetrated Dhamma to some extent, we're going to question and wonder about everything we see. Take a look at that Brahmin. Even though he's staring the Buddha right in the face, he was still filled with doubt and uncertainty. I am the Buddha. The Brahma still didn't believe him. He just turned and walked away. The only way to experience enlightenment is through seeing the Dhamma. As the Buddha has already taught, one who sees the Dhamma sees me. But one who lives with me, stays in the same kuti with me, and even hangs onto the edge of my robe his whole life, I don't say that he knows me one bit. See, it's the citta that makes the difference. Externally, there's no difference. It's only some who appear impressive on the outside. From the beginning, their behavior is impeccable, and when they realize enlightenment, they retain their impeccability. Whatever personalities people have had, after enlightenment, they will most likely be much the same, looking angry, appearing surly. What's the same is simply the appearance, but their hearts are empty. Is there anything else you have doubts about? Question. When living with the Krupa Ajahn, one has to be careful because having doubts and judgmental thoughts about him can be bad karma. Is that right, Tenajan? Answer. I don't like to call it evil because it's natural that the citta will do so. It's unavoidable that the unenlightened citta will be like this. I prefer not to refer to it in that way because it is intertwined with one aspect of the Dhamma we want to know. We want to know the truth. It's not like we're just criticizing the teacher and nothing else. We want to know the truth. If there's bad karma there, it's only partly bad. It's also partly merit. It's not 100% completely bad karma, like that of most people in general. Lompu Jia once saw that someone had thrown away a broken bottle at the foot of a tree, and he asked who had tossed it there. It was one of the monks, so Lompu had him called over. When the monk came, Lompu punched him right in the mouth. Bleeding, the monk got angry, so Lompu punched him again. Chuckling, was he angry? He wasn't angry. That's Lompu Jia's character. But those of us who don't know anything see him and say, there, that's kilesa, and make a big deal out of it. If we have kilesa, it's unavoidable that we'll create issues like this, because the kilesas don't want us to understand the Dhamma. Understanding Dhamma means understanding kilesas. Look at this. They don't want us to understand the Dhamma, so they've got to create all sorts of stories to deceive us, spewing up proliferating thoughts so we won't have faith. If we don't have faith, then we'll believe the kilesas. See, this is how kilesa works. If there are kilesas there, they will grab at anything and everything to use for their own devices. It's the same with Dhamma. Everything we see can be used to bring beneficial results. Everything kilesas see is taken in for our own harm. Those people who were born in time to see the Buddha were the most fortunate. The manner and deportment of the Buddha was unsurpassed. There wasn't a single thing that those observing him could object to. Even his chief disciples, Venerables Ananda, Sariputta, and Moggallana, couldn't match him. The quality of the present-day enlightened teachers has declined even further. it's no longer possible to appear impeccable in every aspect. So when those who'd accumulated the most merit and had the highest spiritual potential were reborn, they met the Buddha himself. They'd just see the Buddha and their doubts would vanish. In just listening to a brief Dhamma discourse, they'd get enlightened. These days, however, those of us listening to someone teaching the Dhamma don't really know if he's any different than we are, so it's natural that we'd have some doubts. That's the way it is. Question: how does one bring balance and joy to the practice? Answer: in the beginning, it's not necessarily all that fun, not so enjoyable. There's lots of dukkha, because with everything we've got to struggle against and resist defilements. When we've started a new job and haven't seen a penny of our wages, there's lots of dukkha. We suffer with the hassles of our responsibilities at work. Once we get paid, however, then we're happy. It's the same when we're combating the kilesas and when we're training ourselves in bhavana. Dukkha is predominant. But once we've developed peace of mind, happiness is predominant. Don't go looking for bliss and enjoyment in the early stages of bhavana. There isn't any. Mostly it's dukkha, struggling and resisting, until we've realized some of the fruits of our efforts, until we've attained some samadhi and punya. From that point on, it starts getting fun. We're having a good time, and our effort reaches the stage where we're pushing ourselves to the limit. Life is forgotten, death is forgotten, eating is forgotten, sleeping is forgotten. When it's like that, it's truly fun. But don't expect that in the beginning. It's not like that at all. It's a difficult and challenging practice, because there's a huge amount of kilesas buried in our hearts. Like when you see things of one sort or another, you can't help but to proliferate around it. To resist doing this is extremely difficult. Seeing the smallest thing, you're already making an issue out of it. To resist this tendency is extremely difficult. The citta isn't dwelling joyfully. No fun. Question: as a simile for describing progress in practice, would you say it's like climbing a mountain where the view keeps getting better and better? Answer: yes, that's right. Question: or like digging a tunnel through a mountain where the deeper you go, the darker it gets, until suddenly you break through to the light on the other side? Answer: both ways are correct. Either way will lead to success. If you're going to climb a mountain, climb until you've succeeded. If you're going to penetrate through a tunnel, persist in that until you've made your way through to the other side. Whatever leads to success, you can consider that to be good. Characters are different. For some people, the more they climb, the higher they get. For others, it just keeps getting darker and darker. But when there's no slackening of effort, one is able to reach the peak of the mountain, while another can penetrate through a tunnel. Of all the different types of people, with their differing personalities and characters, those endowed with great effort and patient endurance are the ones who are able to succeed. In whatever they set out to do, they are able to meet with success. At such times, it's as if everything is Dhamma leading to success. People and personalities are different, but all I ask is that everyone put forth effort. Then everyone has the ability to realize the Dhamma. One fellow doesn't like mountaineering, preferring to dig. Then get down to it and dig. In time, he'll penetrate. Another fellow doesn't like that. He prefers to climb a mountain. In time, he'll attain the summit. There was one monk. Sariputta had him do a subha contemplation, but it didn't work for him. The Buddha, however, told him to contemplate subha, and that worked. Different. One monk was given the meditation of contemplating anicchang, but had no success. Later, he took up contemplation of dukkha and met with success. Other monks succeed by contemplating anicchang, while investigating in any other way is fruitless. This is how characters are different. Anything can be considered Dhamma if it leads to truth. If you're going to drill a tunnel, then get in there and drill. Whatever happens, just keep drilling. No matter how dark it gets, endure. Until at one point the tunnel reaches the other side and light floods in. Another person treks his way up a mountain until one day he reaches the summit. There he finds light as well. Whoever you are, you have the right to attain Magga, Pala, and Nibbana. It isn't dependent on what sex you are or your age. It doesn't have to do with worldly knowledge or how world-wise you are. It solely has to do with correct practice. Magga, Pala, and Nibbana is there for everyone. It's not a wealth that belongs to anyone in particular. Whoever has wisdom can make it their own. So whether one is climbing a mountain or digging a tunnel, if one's wisdom is agile, one can achieve quick success. Either way, one is repaid equally, repaid with a heart full of happiness. Understand? Question. What reflection has Tanajan used to overcome despair at those times when the practice seemed impossible? Answer. I looked at all the dukkha I had been through. This is why it's recommended to extensively contemplate our own bodies. In all that this body's been through, what experiences have we met? Take a look at your parents. Look at other people you know. There's more dukkha experience than sukha. It's the same with all beings. From birth until their dying day, dukkha is more prevalent than sukha. What we're doing here is for going beyond dukkha. If we don't do it, we'll be no different than the average person, immersed in this dukkha, never able to conquer it. In this way, the heart that has fallen into despair can rise up again to fight. If we don't battle with kilesas, they just keep on destroying us. Simply continuing on without doing anything about it, there won't ever be a time when our heart's free. The only option is to fight on. At times the heart despairs. Continue on. You fast for 10 days, 15 days, and the mind's still not peaceful. You try not lying down for 15 days, the mind's not peaceful. No matter what you do, there's no peace of mind. You feel totally washed out. The practice just seems weak and washed out. Frustration and dejection set in. But then you think of the massive dukkha that's awaiting you. How many more times will I have to die and be reborn? Possibly I'll fall into hell. Possibly I'll be born as an animal. Possibly I'll have to. Who knows? Who knows what dukkha I'd have to undergo that would be far more painful than putting forth effort here and now. In that case, it's better to put forth effort. The heart gradually rises up to it. Do you understand? No, I don't. Ajahn Wanchai laughs. Everyone gets discouraged at times, even our Kruba Ajahns. They sometimes despaired. Longpu Bantat told me how he once went through such a period, practicing as if it were a matter of life and death. He still wasn't getting any results. Despair. At times, tears flow. Tanajan Cherry told me how discouraged he became at times, of how he cried. No matter what I do, nothing comes of it. Rely on our fear of dukkha. We don't want to have more suffering in the future. As a human, we only experience dukkha to this extent, but those beings in hell and those in the animal realm experience even more than we do, many times more than we do. Taking this all into account, it's better to do battle right here, battling uphill, gradually battling uphill. At that time, when we're getting close to seeing the Dhamma, there's no such thing as discouragement. There's only the fight. Any more? Do you have any more problems? Question. How does one wake up the warrior, the power of the warrior within one? Answer. In the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha held up Dukkhang Arya Satchang as the primary teaching. Contemplate right here. Contemplate extensively. When you've contemplated everything, all things, all people, beings and all their diversity, it makes no difference. There's only Dukkhang Arya Satchang leading the way. Why? Because these beings aren't warriors. They've never been Dhamma warriors, so they have to suffer defeat at the hands of Kilesa and endlessly undergo a mass of suffering. Once we've seen this, there's no choice but to be a fighter. Whatever happens, we have to be one. Whatever the outcome, we have to wrestle with the Kilesas. Whatever happens, we have to put forth effort. Dukkhang Arya Satchang, you see this, the Buddha raised it up as the very first of the truths. Wherever you look, there's only Dukkhang, the noble truth of dukkha. Humans are suffused by it. All manner of beings are suffused by it. Because they're not Dhamma warriors, they're only Kilesa warriors. The Buddha was exceedingly wise in bringing this statement to the forefront in all its depth and profundity, so we'd find the strength in our hearts to fight. Fight in a way that none of those beings immersed in the world fight. That's why those beings have to endure cycles of death and rebirth, losing to Kilesas, defeated by Kilesas since time immemorial. We are no exception. If we're not going to battle with these defilements, we'll have to eternally suffer defeat at the hands of Kilesa the entire time. Whoever doesn't look for and investigate dukkha ends up looking for and investigating sukha. What can I do to be comfortable? What can I do to be rich? What can I do to live and eat well? They've never seen the teaching Dukkhang Arya Satchang that the Buddha held up for us. Beings in the world are doing the exact opposite, only investigating sukham. What can I get to make me happy? How can I get sukha? The Buddha taught the exact opposite. He had us contemplate and see the truth of dukkha from the outset. Birth, illness, old age, and death are dukkha. Sorrow, grief, separation from what we like, and experiencing things we don't like are all forms of dukkha. Once we see that this is the way things are, we think, how can I fight to overcome this mass of suffering? If we're the ones creating the suffering, our kilesas leading us to suffer, then even just once we have a skirmish with the kilesas. Overpower the kilesas even just once. Then make sure you eradicate them. One's fighting stance then begins to surface. When contemplating and seeing the Dhamma of the Buddha, when contemplating and seeing his teachings, we see that he taught in order that we be true warriors. Have you ever seen the extent of this mass of dukkha? Once you've seen it, know that it's because we've never battled as warriors that we've ended up with it all. The only contemplation we've done has been for seeking pleasant feelings and comfort. From now on, I'd recommend extensively contemplating dukkha ngariya sachang, okay? So that you see the truth, what's true for all beings. Others have fallen into this pile of dukkha as well. Contemplate so that you won't want to be or become anything else. A millionaire with loads of money suffers dukkha too. Being a king is dukkha. Being anything is dukkha. The dukkha of others is no different than ours. So we don't want to be anything whatsoever. The mind then becomes peaceful. Bhavana with determination, all right? Watch carefully. Kilesas are constantly budding their way into our hearts. Even though we're practicing Dhamma, we don't recognize them. Kilesa leads us far away, doubting about this, speculating about that, on and on. Even something like doing things quickly gives rise to doubt. You see, kilesas never take a break. They make us doubt about everything. How will doubts vanish? They'll vanish because we awaken to the Dhamma. Confusion will completely cease. There will be no uncertainty remaining. Whether you see the Lord Buddha or not, it doesn't make any difference. You don't doubt. Whether you see the Sangha or not, you don't doubt about anything at all. But this only arises from effort, okay? Make sure you do a good job of it. The fact that all of you have ordained as monks shows you've got a lot of determination. Have faith that in your hearts you've got a great store of accumulated good qualities. As for myself, I'm already Thai. It didn't require much effort to ordain. The sight of monks was common, and ordination was readily available. But all of you have had to make an effort, because you're highly determined. Take this determination and use it to fight. Make sure you really do it. Whether Thai or Farang, you have the ability to realize the Dhamma just the same. No matter what nationality you are, there's an equal opportunity to awaken to the Dhamma. Even if you're a novice, it doesn't matter if you're a monk or a novice. You see, no difference. You can succeed as well. Take that for now.
Sometimes, like a little bit of greed will come up, and apply like an antidote, like say whatever. If it's craving, then apply some asubha, and then it'll actually seem like it's exacerbating it. And I've heard this simile of like heated up stone, and you pour like cold water on it, and all this like steam comes up, and you think, oh, this steam's coming up, and it's something bad is happening, but it's cooling out the rock. And I'm wondering if you have any encouragement or Lumpo Cha, like if any similes to like encourage that when you're applying it and you're doing it skillfully, but it seems to be like actually like flaring things up. But
one is to you have to be investigating all the time, but it's. The aspect of having Ajahn Chah just over and over and over again, how many times he told us, just be patient, keep working, be practice, practice works. You think that he says it's. Oh, he gave a lovely image of. He said it's like you know, you put a, what you want to do is put like a cage of mindfulness and wisdom around your defilements, and you think, well, you know, that should just sort of contain them. The reality is a, he said it's like putting a tiger in a cage. So of course, as soon as you put the tiger in a cage, and it just wants to get out, and sort of, it roars and bats the bars of the cage, and of course after a while it gets tired and sits down and gets up and sort of roars and charges the cage and it keeps. And the thing to do is just keep it in the cage. Don't feed it. Don't engage with it. Don't try to get in the cage and try to force it to be quiet. Just be able to watch. You know, after being patient and not feeding it and being skillful, not encouraging it in any way. So after a while, that tiger just every once in a while just sort of lift its head.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is the we tend to that the doing mind wants to, I've got to do something, and that's where it tends to exacerbate things, or we're expecting it to, all of a sudden. You're kind of trying to strike a deal with it. Okay, I'm going to be restrained now, and you're going to be quiet. and then you sort of restrain yourself for a bit, and then look and say, okay, now you're supposed to be quiet, aren't you? And of course they say, no, you can't. But it's a lot of what we're doing is trying to strike a deal with it rather than actually kind of relinquish.
Whereas we talked about the citta as like sort of pure awareness, sometimes a metaphor for the citta being pure awareness.
There's lots of definitions and there's lots of ideas.
Mm-hmm. And I am recognizing that it's a concept I'm not going to really get very far with what I'm about to ask you, but so we talked about it. But I might be a little bit.
You'll try anyway.
So, like, we talked about the awareness being in the fourth kanda, the sankhara kanda. It sounds like he's talking about something different, like maybe the activity of awareness, or, like what we're doing when we are being aware is in the fourth kanda, but the rebirth that he's talking about with the citta being outside of the five khandhas, and someone who's a Arya Pugala, someone who's...
Even, he wasn't even using that in terms of rebirth, as if the citta is rebirth, just outside of it completely.
Could you...
Try.
Say something about that? That was
no,
confusing.
I'm not going to say anything.
Okay.
Because it's just, all you're going to do is grab it and then try to get another definition that tries to fit into, you have to practice. This is experience. The ability to recognize there is that which is beyond birth and death. There is that which is beyond, and you're not gonna, and then you say, well, what is it, and how is it, and how should it be? And it's just the same as trying to continue, that in the Savasava Sutta, how was I in the past? What was I in the past? What will I be in the future? Huh? What am I now? Am I now? So that conceiving, and as soon as you get into conceiving, you've already started the process of dukkha. The whole conceptual process is the engaging with dukkha.
So it would be better to hear what he said and just let it go, in terms of it just being a concept and just saying, well, when I notice awareness and when there is awareness, that's good. I don't have to make anything out of it.
You don't
do anything with it.
Yeah.
You can just utilize it.
Yes.
And if it kind of comes
and
there's a recognition that there's something separate, then great.
Yeah.
But
I mean, you can use those as concepts to stimulate an investigative process, but you're not going, the investigation is not a conceiving. The best investigation is when the mind is exceedingly still and not conceiving, not creating concepts. And it's like how Ajahn Chah reiterated how important it was the advice that he received from Ajahn Mun to be able to recognize the difference between the mind and the moods of the mind. So that the citta and the aramana of the citta. And that those are two different things. But that's on an experiential level. It's not on a conceiving level. As soon as you start trying to conceive it, that just the conception itself is an aramana of the citta. It's a movement of the citta.
It's more of a realizing.
Yes.
The difference between trying to conceive and investigating with, that has good results would be that there's a realizing, not a conceiving mind, but a realizing.
You have to, one of the things is recognizing the dukkha involved in the conceiving. That movement towards having to have a view, an idea, a conception, a construct.
From self?
Well, I mean, that's a construct. That's a construct. Self, it is a construct. It's just
when he was talking about the means to, when he's asked the question about the means to deal with despair, he gave several examples of practitioners working on a theme and not getting anywhere and falling into despair. And I don't think he actually kind of gave a direct answer of like anything to do with it, but just keep chipping away at it.
Yeah.
Is there, if you're working on something and, like, say you're contemplating anicca, and you're, viewing the anicca aspect of everything that's happening, minute by minute, hour by hour, and nothing's happening, nothing's changing in your experience, you're just kind of doing this and doing this and doing this. Sometimes the mind flies away. Sometimes you come back and you're doing it and doing it. Eventually you'll decide, okay, this isn't working, and you decide to try something else. Is it the case that you just have to kind of try them all, like keep...
Oh, yeah.
It's just totally... No one can sort of help you find out which thing's going to work for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, unless you wait for the next Buddha. Maybe he'll...
I'm not waiting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so no, it's really a... just keep working this. And, this is really not working. Trying something else. And that's also where Kaliya Nimitta is really important. Just having that contact with a good spiritual friendship. Because the external is an important support. The internal process. I find it interesting with Ajahn Wanchai in his one dealing with, in his talks in dealing with despair, and I think it was very good. Also, contemplation of dukkha. And he never refers to himself. And he's somebody who's had a spinal injury and is in chronic debilitating pain. It's really quite interesting. Puts it into another light again. That's okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. That's something.
When I was there, staying there, he was eating in a hospital bed. They would roll the bed into the sala, and he would sit up and no show of pain, but others would tell me he has this very, very extreme condition, and they thought he was going to die several times.
Yeah,
it's very, very extreme.
Now that puts brackets around that. Mm-hmm. Contextualizes is the teaching of the way.
Well, the story you gave about having—I forgot the exact details—but the monk that threw a bottle away in a tree, and,
right?
And I forgot who we went to, or
Lumpajie.
If I understand correctly, Lumpajie hit him twice, punched him.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking.
I know, who's the words they always do things three times.
I didn't quite understand the point of that. It's sort of like.
It was some sort of broken bottle. I've never heard the story, some sort of broken bottle, and it was just sort of tossed somewhere. Mm-hmm. It was really sloppily done. Something was really sloppily done in his monastery, and Lobodjia didn't. He doesn't suffer fools, and he. Yeah, they don't know the background of the actual person. Lumbajia is. I don't know how Buddha described Lumbajia as a. He is a diamond.
Gold wrapped in a rag.
I heard gold wrapped, a shitty rag. his nature. I thought Ajahn Wanchai expressed it really when somebody's personality, just because they're enlightened, it doesn't mean their personality changes. I mean, it's tempered, or it's kind of maybe softened a bit, but they don't suddenly become completely different people. So somebody like Ajahn Chah, he was always even when he was a kid, he was the center of attention. He was the kid that all the other kids wanted to be with. It was just his somebody like Ajahn Chah sort of saying, Lopute, and he's very refined, very dignified, and personally he's this extremely peaceful person, he always ends up with people around him who are creating problems and difficulties. And he's this incredibly noble figure who doesn't seem to ever have people around him. Yeah, so it, you know, so oh yeah, it was his personality, his temperament, his karmic propensities, and you know, it's just his very people are different. And, you bring, even if you're enlightened, you bring, you know, a whole lot of baggage into the package. So no point here, remember. It's just quite coarse. Remember reading in his biography. They took him to Australia, and so he's either in business class or first class, and you know, the plane takes off, and the fastened seatbelt thing is on, and he's, you know, he's just talking, he's just up to speak to himself, really out loud to his attendant monk. I'm gonna take a piss. I said, I'm getting up and going, and she said, you can't get up. They don't really need this. You know, what do you mean I can't get up? I'm not even pissing the seat if I can't. get me set. But I guess maybe there was turbulence as well. So anyway, because then it was really sweet, and the stewardess, you know, found some kind of a container. It's just completely, I need a spittoon. I need to take a piss. That was it. And he just had no, it's that level of refinement just doesn't come across his consciousness.
I'm wondering if, the reason why it piqued my attention is because you're trying to evaluate teachers or who you want to spend time with. And it, you know, it's like, gee, you know. how do you, like, you know, use some sort of gender around who you want to spend time with? I guess that was a thing. Obviously, that was such a snapshot, you know, instance.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, and somebody like that is not, I mean, he's not looking to make people comfortable.
Mm.
So, and he had, he never really developed a large following. so that you know, I can imagine it was really difficult to live with.
There's one part of the story in his bio where these monks came to come live with him from Ponsa, and they heard about him, and they're like, their teacher said, don't go live with him. And then the day before the Ponsa starts, he says, oh, I'm leaving. And I got to go take care of little boar, you know, cow. He's my teacher, and I'm leaving. And they start crying, and they're upset. How can you leave? And we were told you know, this was going to happen. And he says, shut up! You know, he just starts screaming at him. And he's like, I'm going to go take care of, you know, little boar cow. This is my teacher. And the next day, same thing. They're all really upset, and he leaves. And then they just stay there for the Ponsa. So it's, you know, it's a similar kind of thing, you know. But they were told, this is what's going to happen. It's interesting, though, the Vinaya rule about hitting another person is out of anger.
Mm.
You know? So, I mean, you know, it's, you don't hit somebody.
Yeah, but it's sort of like, you know, I mean, Mupuji is fine. You know, what this guy needs is a real pop in the mouth.
So it's not necessarily that he was experiencing anger, just like that was the whole point of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are, and somebody else's mind. So that's where you end up sort of paying attention to. I mean, it's like there are different teachers, different personalities, different characteristics, and you draw close to those that you feel you can learn from, or you have confidence in them. And others you have to sort of leave it aside.
I'm curious, just reflecting on the Thai tradition, there are these, you know, there's already sort of some fierce teachers, but in some Buddhist traditions, sort of the don't question the guru mentality seems to get way out of hand. Whereas there seems to be, in Thailand, in the Thai, the stories we hear, it doesn't seem to happen so often.
Well, they just leave. You know, I mean, in the sense there isn't a sense that you need to be, if somebody isn't, you're not required to keep, it's actually that, that's, remember Ajahn Chah sort of saying that one time, sort of like it's actually the duty of the teacher to provide the wherewithal for people to stay, rather than it's not as if stay unquestioning with the teacher. And I think generally in Thai, there's a respect is given, but that doesn't mean you stay with them. If somebody is not comfortable with them, they just leave. And that's fairly it's calm. There's a lot of fluid. The monasteries are fluid. There is in sort of Thai culture, Thai temperament, you don't force people to do things. Sort of force somebody to stay in the faith, or force somebody to follow something for somebody. It just doesn't happen, really.
Lumpa, that reminds me of Ajahn Chah's one of the stories that one of the monks wants to leave, and in his wisdom and sense of humor, he says, "Why, don't you like me?" And just kind of drawing out the monk and kind of teaching. So.
For whatever it's worth, I know a monk who stayed from Virginia, he had a lot of devotion to him.
I think that's good to put it in, because I went to pay respects to him. There are monks who were around him, very, very devoted. He was an accomplished being who had his own way of doing things and his own way of being. If you expected him to be somewhere way else, then you're going to be disappointed. But if you take him for what he is, then he's going to display truth. He's seen.
To Tikajana's question, I don't feel that at all here. That sort of sense of you're not being able to question or something. But there was that question there, isn't it bad karma to say something, to be around a group ajahn and say something? And when I was in Thailand, there was that sort of sense of there were certain Western teachers where if you questioned anything that they said, their disciples would get really angry at you. And there was also, like, at that time when Dhamma Bhua was doing the fundraising for the government.
Oh, right.
And some people were critical of that. And there was this really, he's a Krubhajan, and if you say anything bad about it, you're going, you know, bad destiny. So there, and from the Western, younger monks, you know, I heard a lot of that, you know. Kind of, and maybe you'll hear from Thomas.
Yeah, sure, there's, but again, it's sort of people either grew close or went away.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting that question was actually asked, you know, from, and it was actually kind of asked in a pointy way, like, isn't this correct that if you say something bad about a Krubhajan, one child didn't pick it up? Well, I wouldn't see it that way. But it's almost like the person asking the question was wanting to get reconfirmed that is correct. You should never say something bad about it.
Yeah, it would be rare for somebody to be encouraged and kind of blind. I mean, obviously you don't encourage people to go run a bad month and others, but you don't want to encourage and kind of blind. Bad question.
Seems like Lumpurjia, with that, I remember reading his biography, it seems like he did get a little bit more refined, because in his biography, I remember, like, I think there was something, like, he got into an argument with someone that was, it was like, someone's boat was coming onto his family's boat, or there was some argument over, like, boxes of fruits or something like that, like putting boxes of fruits, and he actually, like, uppercut the guy and knock him unconscious, like onto the box of fruits. And so,
yes, he was still laying.
He was still laying. Thank you. So the practice did refine him a little bit.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You need some uppercuts to
say
the
best. No more uppercuts, just a posture. Just a posture, yes.
Okay, time for break.